Welcome to Talking to Grandma, a weekly podcast that elevates stories, science, and strategies to help you raise and teach multilingual and bilingual children. I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides, founder and CEO of Bilingual Generation, an organization that helps children with bilingualism in their bones stay connected to their heritage languages and cultures. I'm also a Harvard-educated doctora who has experienced losing, recovering, and passing on my heritage language to my children. Whether you are a parent, grandparent, teacher, researcher, school leader, or simply someone interested in the topics of language learning and language preservation, this podcast is for you. Through interviews with amazing guests and solo episodes, you will find the resources, guidance, and strategies needed to support you in your journey. Let's get started. In today's episode, Carmen Kennard discusses her journey of embracing and maintaining Black language throughout her life, despite the challenges she faced in academia.
Looking back on it now, I'm in a Black church. So then there's sort of Black languages just surrounding me. And as I get further in school, I'm making decisions that I'm not giving this up. Wow. Not for these white people around me. Wow. And I still feel like that now. Yeah, especially in school. I'm not giving this up because no matter even if I've been told that I need to, I'm being told that I need to give up Black language more and more, but what is also happening is I'm also developing an analysis of why whiteness is requiring it.
Carmen Kennard is a Lillian Radford Chair in Rhetoric and Composition and Professor of English at Texas Christian University. Her award-winning research, teaching, and scholarship interrogate anti-racism, Black feminist pedagogies, Afro-digital Black cultures and languages, and the politics of schooling, with an emphasis on composition and literacy studies. She traces her research and her teaching at her website, Education, Liberation, and Black Radical Traditions, which has garnered over 2 million hits since its inception in 2012. Stick around to hear Carmen's message of resilience, joy, and the pursuit of a more inclusive and equitable education system.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Carmen. It is such an honor to have you on as a guest. Our podcast focuses on heritage language preservation and bilingualism. Black language and Black people are often left out of the discussion when it comes to bilingualism. So can you share a little bit about your definition of Black language and if you view it as a heritage language?
Thank you for that question. Yes, I absolutely view it as a heritage language. And absolutely view it as a kind of bilingualism, bidialectalism, biculturalism, maybe even sort of a even in multiple iterations, given just sort of regional differences. And also, if we begin to think of Black language in a kind of diaspora way, where we're also talking about Jamaican Nation language, Trinidadian Nation language, and even, you know, outside of the bounds of English, if you're talking about Haitian Creole, that there are ways that Black people are not just relating to language, but doing language. In for Black political, Black cultural, Black communication needs that are inherently different, that are going to have to be different for just in terms of Black survival and just in sort of one in any political moment where you think that Black life or Black opportunity is improving, you get a quick slap in the face and see that white backlash is coming right back for you. And in that way, I also in my own life, I didn't necessarily develop a specific consciousness about the language that I use to talk about language. So maybe later, and by later, I mean like junior high school. But there was a kind of, I had a very Black interior life and still do, but I was raised with a Black interior life that was attempting to keep me safe from white institutions. Mm-hmm. So, and in that way, language is also developing and very important in that way, in that space, and, you know, in ways that I wasn't necessarily articulating because I was simply living.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your relationship to Black language from, how that shifted, as you said, from childhood, from your home life to entering the school system to now you're in academia, which isn't necessarily the most welcoming place for Black language. So, how has your relationship to Black language, your heritage language, shifted over the years?
I would say that it's a kind of story of a deliberate defiance that has just blossomed. Would call it a blossoming. I would go ahead and call it a blossoming because so I grew up in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio. So this is Northwest Ohio, and I grew up in a very it was very segregated. Again, I don't know that I knew it was segregated or that I called it segregated. I like to think of it now because I feel like that's white language. I think of it now as a very Black interior life, and the positive that means. So even so for instance, like my first memory of school is probably getting bussed in first grade. So all these Black kids are bussed into this what was before a Black, I mean a very white elementary school. And at one point I remember at the end of the day they didn't have enough buses. So what they would do, a good majority of the white kids walked home and their parents came and got them. And then but then there was a busload of white kids. Those white kids got taken home first. And the Black kids all had to wait until the buses came back to pick us up and take us. And what and I didn't realize just I couldn't articulate, I should say, I couldn't articulate just how much that process and that practice was designed to mark us as inferior and unwanted. Because in that space we had there was one I had in the lower elementary grades, I had this first grade teacher. Her name is Miss Earl. Her name's probably not Miss Earl now. I thought of her as a really old person, but in hindsight, she had to be about maybe 23, 24. She was quite young. But in first grade, I thought that was like, a dinosaur. So, there weren't that many Black kids in my first grade class. But, when we were waiting for the second bus to come, we were all grouped together and we were with her. And I remember that more than anything I learned. It was absolutely wonderful. It's like we had like a bubble gum eating contest who could blow the biggest bubble. And I beat everyone blowing bubble gum bubbles. And that was a promise to her that we wouldn't chew bubble gum unless we were with her. And then, I won the contest. So I was like this queen, but and then there was like all these sort of like hand clap games. And so that is sort of what school looked like. There was this sort of segregated space where Black children were. But it was also a cocoon of Black culture, of Black language. And you have to, and like by first grade, Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang is out. So we are like, performing, and this is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat, right? So we're performing all of this. And it's literally there with me all the time. I begin to have I want to say in junior high school, I'm in honors classes and I'm around more white kids. And I remember my best friend Leah, we made this some of the other Black kids in class were doing, I guess, what people would today call code switching. I don't like the language of code switching, but they were doing this thing where they talked very differently in this white classroom space than when we got in the hallways with all our Black friends, or when we were in the classes where they weren't tracked. So it was a tracking system basically. And I remember being in seventh grade and having this conversation with Leah that we were not going to change our language to sit up here and talk to these white girls. And so, they didn't, and we just didn't care. And then, and what Black kids were doing in that moment. So this, like the Black friends of mine who I'd only see in the hallway, we had this intricate letter writing system where we're passing notes in the hallway to one another and like updating each other on our lives and what we're doing. And reason I remember that, because we signed those letters with you made a big old S and you said, "You're super sweet Sonic Soul Sister." And this is, and so like, and looking back on it now, and this, and you know, and I'm in a Black church. So then there's a sort of Black, there's a Black language is just surrounding me. And as I get further in school, is I'm making decisions that I'm not giving this up. Not for these white people around me. Wow. And I still feel like that now. Yeah, especially in school. I'm not giving this up because no matter even if I've been told that I need to, I'm being told that I need to give up Black language more and more. But what is also happening is I'm also developing an analysis of why whiteness is requiring it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. There's so much to dig into there. I want to learn more about where that conviction came from as a young child to say, I'm not going to switch. I'm not going to, I want to know more about code switching and why that term, you view it as something that you don't want to use or problematic. And also how you were able to identify so early that you weren't going to switch your language for the benefit or for the comfort of the white audience or the white gaze. And I think about my experience growing up in my neighborhood, which was largely Black and Latino, and there was like one white kid in the whole school, right? And so I as I graduated from high school, went to college, got my master's, got my doctorate, my surroundings just got more and more white. And I saw it as code switching. I saw myself as code switching. And I'm also like, then when you do it for so long and you're surrounded by that for so long, you kind of get stuck in that code. Like, it's like, I use my home language dialect, not Spanish, but just the way that I would speak English growing up, only when I'm at home, which is not all the time or not as frequent. So yeah, I'd love to learn more about like how you were grounded in that conviction that you weren't going to shift so early and so young, and how you maintain and stay in that now in the world of academia.
Well, I think at some point, like when I was younger, particularly, I want to say high school, this really developed. And in high school, because I really just saw, I didn't really see school as part of my life. Or I shouldn't say part, it was part, it's a big part of your life because you have to spend so much time there. And they give you so much homework, and I think that's the home. You know what I mean? Like, they just, you know, they do the most with the schools thing. But I didn't see it as, like, it was just a hustle. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, and I saw school, because I grew up very poor, school was a way out of poverty. Mm-hmm. I knew I wasn't going to play any kind of athletics, because I just, you know, that's a wrap for me. I also knew I wasn't going to be like an entertainer or a singer, because mm-hmm. I can't carry a note. So I didn't, my only option was school. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, and it was just very obvious that it had rules. There were things that you needed to do. There were certain kind of ways to get a scholarship. But I, you know, the other thing, I never saw school as learning. I never saw myself learning. I was just, you know, even so, like, I want to say in high school, like, I was in these honors English classes. And I mean, this is also very ironic. Like, I hated English and history classes. It's ironic. That's what I do now. I only like math, really, because math, there was an answer and you didn't have to deal with all this other foolishness that they were always talking about and all this boring white stuff. And so, like, one of the things I used to like to do in my English class in high school, which is also very white. I'm at a private high school now. But what I would do in high school is you could figure out which of, and it always intersected with wealth, with white wealth. You could tell which girls the nuns like the best and which mm-hmm. answers they like the best. So I didn't read a single book in high school.
Wow.
I got A's throughout high school English. I just copied. I just would listen to what the important white girls were saying. And, you mm-hmm. know, if it sounded stupid, I would just refute what she was saying, or I would add another example. And, you know, mm-hmm. and so, and the white nuns loved it. Mm-hmm. So that was my hustle through high school. But I didn't, mm-hmm. you know, because I needed an A to go to college so I could get a job. But I wasn't mm-hmm. reading that stuff. And mm-hmm. I was only listening to hustle it up. So that was part of it. And then, you know, in college, that gets challenged, because college is literally the first place where I'm reading Black writers, where I'm reading Black women writers. And I'm looking at what they do with language. And I'm seeing, like, you know, So I'm in college at the first time, I think it was Terry McMillan, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison are both on the New York Times bestsellers list. And this has never been in, you know, in the history of publishing and writing. And I'm look and the characters and the people who they writing about, I recognize them. And I never wanted to be a creative writer. I never thought of myself as someone who's going to be a fiction writer, but I wanted my writing to sound like that. Mm-hmm. And that became a problem. Mm-hmm. And I also was at this point, this is also sort of, you know, the early Bell Hooks might be maybe on her third or fourth book at this time, only on her fourth book. So I'm also reading Bell Hooks heavily. Bell Hooks, I feel like her language is very academic, but it's also very sister girl. It's all, and like I, you know, and I'm taking these like women's studies classes, these feminist studies classes, and my white women professors are telling me, I'm saying, you know, I want to sound like Bell Hooks. I want to write like Bell Hooks. And they're telling me I can't, that's not what academic writing is, but they're assigning her. And so at that point, I'm like, I don't trust white feminism. I don't trust white feminism. And I'm, you know, the kind of these performances of allyship fall apart at the language, fall apart at Black women speak. There's one particular Black woman professor had. She was a sort of visiting professor, and it was a class where all we did was read Toni Morrison. And I think one of the papers, I decided to write a letter to Sula as a imagining myself as a little Black girl learning from her. And this professor told me that made me rewrite it, that this wasn't appropriate. This isn't the way you talk about literature. I just thought of her as someone bougie and compromised and tokenized.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and at that point, I remember rewriting the paper and deciding I was not going to do that every. It was I was very torn because it was a Black woman professor, and I didn't want to drop the class, and I didn't want to write her a negative evaluation, because student evaluations count in that space, and a student evaluation of a Black professor really counted, and so I was in a kind of conundrum around Black solidarity, even though she was showing none as far as I was concerned. Yeah. It made me, and I think those two experiences may have been in the same semester. I don't know if it's the same semester, it was definitely the same year. And so I started picking my professors differently. I wanted to see if people walk what they talk, and not just because that particular Black woman professor looked very similar to white women who are co-opting Black women's texts, but not really meaning it. And so, you know, and I began to question these people who do this thing where Black language is what you put in quotation marks when you quote somebody else, and versus not how you speak, and being very clear that that's not what Zora Neale Hurston was doing. Yeah. That is what you're doing at this white university. That continues throughout. It hasn't happened at my current institution, but at my previous institution, where like the white chair of the department will call me in and try to explain to me that the language that I'm using on my syllabus is inappropriate. You know, and I'm tenured. I'm a tenured professor, and people still would try and call me in. And I'm like, I remember my last institution. This was at the City University of New York. It is 75% Black and Latino, and the white chairwoman calls me in to explain my language to me and how it's inappropriate. And so she wants me to revise it, and so I revise it and do it up more. And then I even made a video to go with it.
Oh wow! I mean, just hearing all of the times in which you are actively being confronted with someone who may look like they understand or that they support Black language, pushing against the existence of it in certain spaces, saying that it doesn't belong. And just like I'm reflecting on the, not only have do you have to exist in this academic space and do the work of that and the academic rigor of that, but also the mental work that you're doing in order to respond to all of these different reactions to your humanity, to your existence, to your language, which is a lot. And a lot just in, you know, I guess, like you said, maybe it looks like we're advancing as a society and we're starting to more publicly say Black Lives Matter, and it feels like we're having more ethnic studies and, you know, anti-racism discussions. And then now we have a white lash, right? Which is like a complete, I guess, outright denial of the right for certain texts or language or identities to be present in academic spaces, from universities to preschools. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about your thoughts on like how you're experiencing that and how you think that impacts Black students and Black families, like everyday families that are going into schools that are living and existing in these environments.
I kind of feel like it's in some ways it is, it's almost like a gut punch, in the sense that it's like, I would say people who have a political analysis of white supremacy understand that school was never a safe space. And in these moments where it looked like there was an opening, that's taken back. I think the thing to the place of hope or encouragement I would say in all of this is this backlash is a response to success. It is, and it, you know, as much as people try to turn back the hands of time, white supremacy really, it doesn't have that kind of power. That's just not how the universe works, right? Mm-hmm. So even in this moment around book bans, I mean, we have more, sort of just thinking about, like, I love YAL. I mean, the kind of, mm-hmm. in what kinds of things that are available for Brown and Black children in YAL, and the stories are just amazing and beautiful in ways that I just didn't even have access to growing up. So I am 52. That wasn't something that I had access to.
I'm just going to name for our audience quickly. YAL is young adult literature. So what your, you know, teenagers might be reading.
So yeah, so like this kind of just this, I mean, complete outpouring of a kind of stories and fiction and novels where the main protagonists are teenagers who are Black and Brown and who are going through really real stuff, and some of it in like magical, you can get magical stuff, you can get real stuff, you can get just stories of friends, just what's available. The book bans alone are not going to stop that trend. It's just, it's not. But you can see why it's responding to that. So it's just a reminder, this is something you still have to fight for, and, you know, and worth fighting for. Because like I said, like these books and these stories have been incredibly beautiful. So for instance, this sort of step back, this sort of constantly wanting to go back, that kind of white supremacy wants you to do. Well, communities of color can step back too. Like there's, no matter where you step back to, there's amazing resilience there. Amazing resistance, amazing protests. So even I'm thinking about, I'm blanking on the name of the study and the authors, but I remember it was a study out of Chicago, and it was two authors, and what they were studying, these different, they had dozens of Black families, and they acknowledged sort of some of the limitations of the study and how they were doing it, but they wanted to see, they basically had these two groups of parents. One group of parents who were constantly reminding Black children, I don't want to say that so negatively, but their focus with their own children was on white supremacy, on what racism was going to be and do to them. Mm-hmm. And there was another group of Black parents who really, they talked about that when they had to, but mostly they enveloped their kids in stories of Black culture and Black empowerment. You know, with more of maybe sort of what we might call an African-centered lens, and very much about the arts. And when they followed those young people, and they looked at them in high school and in college, you know, sort of looked to make sure that the resources and the economics and the, you know, salaries, all these kinds of things are similar. Mm-hmm. So there are big like economic or political differences between these families. The ones who were enveloped in this Black cultural apparatus were more resilient in schools. Mm. They were healthier and understanding themselves through college and were less depressed. All these kinds of things. So I think that this study is 20 years old now, at least 20 years old. It's from when I was in grad school when I read it. But I think the lesson there still holds is that not sort of Jim Crowing young Black people to making them think that this moment there's nothing for you, you're just doomed to the eternal hell of your Blackness, versus looking at just this kind of what the richness of a Black interior life, of a Black cultural life. I think that's it's what our communities have always done. We need to keep doing it.
Wow, that's really powerful. And it makes me think a lot about positive racial identity development and how incredibly important that is for, like you said, resiliency. You know, conversations about race doesn't always have to focus on our pain or our suffering or all of the, you know, challenges of racism, but there's a lot of positive aspects to our racial identities that children should be grounded in and should understand. And for white racial identities, understanding their privilege and how they can leverage that in order to create a more just and equal world. And so, you know, it's definitely a powerful lens and conversation to look at. Carmen, you mentioned kind of what a rich home and Black internal environment could look like. I'm curious to know, because we have a lot of our listeners are parents and educators. When we work with educators, and we're, you know, our organization, Bilingual Generation, is talking about bilingualism. And when we talk about Black language as another language, as a legitimate language that should be honored and celebrated, educators are sometimes surprised because they are sometimes taught that that language is incorrect or an inferior form of English. And so I'm curious to know, like, if you work with K-12 educators, what's your message to them around Black language and how that intersects with their work with Black students and families?
When I work with, you know, across the board, helping people understand this sort of the deep history and the deep philosophy that is Black language, and questioning people, even just questioning language about what's right, what's wrong, proper, improper, slang, school, academic, all these kinds of modes of segregation, the Jim Crow segregation, sort of getting people to think about that, particularly, and you know, it's a hard conversation because people have to look at how they themselves have internalized white supremacy and how they're promoting it. And sometimes educators who have committed themselves to Brown and Black children don't want to hear the ways that they have also internalized white supremacy. And there's a way that you can be racist and be incredibly anti-Black if you just talk about language, as if you aren't talking about Black bodies and Black people. And so there's a kind of comfort that happens there, and taking back some of that comfort. There's also, and this is also happening in the context of a culture that is always heavily appropriating Black language. It's everywhere. You know, the t-shirts that you have, it's just everywhere, constantly appropriating it. And so this message, it makes you on board with a message that Black language is only for the purposes of white consumption, in the sense of white people making money off of it. And so just kind of like having to interject there and giving people tools to understand what Black language actually is, what it does, how it does what it does. And some of the things that they're telling young people are incorrect have been in existence for hundreds of years. So Black people are not talking this way and using these kind of grammatical constructs or these kind of metaphors or these kinds of styles because they can't do something else. And why should Black children believe you when you tell them that to give up all of that they're going to somehow gain some kind of corner in this white supremacist world that will never be given to them? They're always going to have to fight for. So, I mean, some of this is like, it's also getting people to think more about how you talk to people, how you talk to young people, particularly about white supremacy in deeper ways. Like, you know, I remember when I used to teach remedial classes, I started teaching college writing with remedial classes. A great deal of that work was at a Black college. And I used to tell my Black students all the time there, and they were in remedial classes, and there was a lot at stake. If they didn't pass these summer bridge programs or these remedial classes, they couldn't take credit-bearing courses. And so all of their financial aid, scholarship, tuition money would be wrapped up in courses that aren't going to count for them. And so one of the things I would say to them, you know, is if grammar was the only thing Black people had to worry about in this world, we would be all right. We would be all right, because that is not some hurdle. So do not let white schools tell you that, or convince you that, or that if you mimic these kind of white codes, that somehow the pearly gates are going to open for you, because they are not. So those are very real conversations we have to, but that takes a certain kind of analysis of schooling, of institutions, of whiteness, of anti-Blackness that people need to have. I think what I get from parents and educators of color the most is a real fear of their children's stigmatization and wanting to help them acquire some kind of armor. And so a standardized white language is going to do that. People talk from a real place of pain, from their own narratives around making sure young people know this is, if you talk this way, if you do this, this is what's going to happen to you in the white world. And again, like my concern with some of that for parents, teachers, and children is this sort of pedagogy, is this teaching model where we give young people of color this message that their bodies are doomed to this eternal hell. And there's no joy in that. Like, you are Jim Crowing your parenting. You're Jim Crowing your classrooms in ways I don't think you intend. How can we turn that into a space of joy that acknowledges white supremacy? It's very much a punishment discourse. It's a carceral discourse. I think a lot of parents and educators have to undo their own sort of inner carcerality around Blackness that they need to confront. That's going to be some deeply painful work also. But I think it's just so harsh and so punishing the way people present their heritage language to young people, you know, in terms of what the dangers are. And it's a lie that taking it away and giving something else is going to give them this coat of armor. And it's rules that don't apply really to white people who aren't speaking and writing in the standardized language that, like, you know, they're getting stereotyped as being, you know, just innate to them.
Wow. I'm just processing all of that, because it hits, it's really powerful. And I'm wondering, Carmen, like, if the narrative started to shift in a really big way where we could honor, celebrate not only Black language, but like the heritage languages of all of our people and our students and children, like, you know, what would that world look like? Like, what could we gain from that vision?
I think it would be a fuller humanity. It's just anti-human to imagine that we only use one language, or one language is more than another, or that one code of a language is more than another. And like the fact that you have to commit so much violence, and so much imperialism, and so much colonization to get that message out should tell you that it is not. I don't want to be so sort of like myopic as to say, you know, if we were truly just a multilingual humanity, we wouldn't have colonization and imperialism. It's going to take a lot to counter that as a mentality, as a structure, all of these kinds of things. It has to do with achieving a fuller humanity and achieving a world, a decolonized world. And, you know, a kind of world that none of us have experienced. And, you know, when you think about other, you know, outside of the United States, outside of the global North, how many languages people speak, just fluently and not just fluently, but with the fluidity, and have this imposition of, I mean, they also can do the sort of European colonial languages also because they have to, but that is so normative in most of the world tells us something. And, you know, and just the sort of the unnatural and violent ways that we have to say that is a language inferiority, that is language struggle versus sort of being like super language users is, again, you know, like, so you think about those young people or those adults who come to the United States and are marked as people who struggle with language. And it's when the exact opposite is true.
Completely. They're labeled English language learners instead of multilingual learners. Like, come on.
Monolingualism isn't even healthy for your brain. Mm-mm. So, I mean, you know, even when you look at sort of instances of Alzheimer's and things like the way that people are beginning to connect, like where do we see this? Where don't we? I mean, like, it's just not even, it's not fully utilizing your human capacity. I will say that.
Right. Well, yeah, also sounds like maybe our bodies are telling us something too, in terms of reclaiming our humanity and tapping into that. And I appreciate you naming what it could look like, because though we sit in these systems of oppression, we have the power to reimagine, to change, like you said, sit in our own individual agency and realize, you know, how we have been colonized and how we may be passing that on, and the ways in which we can shift that to create a better future. So, I mean, Carmen, it has been an incredible honor to talk to you. I'm so grateful that you were able to come on to our podcast to share your work, your life, your thoughts around this very important topic. As we sign off for this episode, I'd love to know, what is bringing you joy these days?
What is bringing me joy? Candles. you know, sort of trying to mimic sitting by the fire. I will also say, like, reading young adult literature, watching what young people do, even on TikTok, all of this. You know, I will say the language brings me joy, because it's just, it's funny. You can cry and laugh and learn at the same time. Imagine different worlds, all of that stuff that, you know, young people living in their language as they want to live in it does for me. So that's bringing me a lot of joy these days.
Thank you for sharing that joy with us. Where can people find you on the internet? Where can they find more information about the work that you're doing?
I'm on Instagram. I'm mostly a lurker, so I'm not necessarily post a lot in that kind of way. I still blog every now and then, usually about something that I'm pissed off about that I just have to work through and write through and figure it out. So I'm still blogging and still trying to understand myself as a sort of academic and researcher, but as a writer. So doing that kind of work also. So yeah, so I think on the blog, you can find me on the blog, usually giving talks here and there at different places, that kind of thing, and on Instagram. And you can, I also have all of the courses that I teach. I have sort of a web space that I have created. So this semester, I'm doing a class around hip hop is language and rhetoric. And that's going to be it's going to happen off a website called Functified. So you can see what my students are up to, what kind of things they're doing, the kind of fun we're going to try to have together this semester.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for inviting me here and for your wonderful questions in this conversation.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked what you heard, take a minute to share this podcast with a friend or colleague. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your ratings and reviews help us to keep the podcast lights on. We can't do this without your support. Every subscription, share, follow, download, and review makes a big difference and helps others find our show. Also, we love hearing from you. Tell us what you think of the podcast. Email us at hello@bilingualgeneration.com. You can also slide into our DMs on Instagram at Talking to Grandma. If you are interested in learning more about our workshops and curricular tools for schools serving multilingual and emerging multilingual students, visit our website at www.bilingualgeneration.com or write us at hello@bilingualgeneration.com. Talking to Grandma is owned by Bilingual Generation. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara, and I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. See you next episode.